For years, eating disorders such as bulimia and the binge-purge subtype of anorexia were thought to be connected to cultural and psychological pressures, especially among girls and women. But a new study by a Michigan State University psychologist indicates binge eating may have biological roots. Dr. Kelly Klump concludes that female rats are more likely to binge eat than males. Her work could influence the science of eating disorders in humans, and Dr. Klump joins me now by phone. Good morning, Kelly Klump.
Good morning.
How did you become interested in studying binge eating? How did you get into this line of work?
Well, binge eating itself, in terms when we think about eating disorders, binge eating is one of the most frequent symptoms of eating disorders. And so it's a symptom that cuts across all the different diagnostic categories of eating disorders. So I've been interested in binge eating per se because if we can really start to understand what might contribute to this key symptom of eating disorders, we might be able to inform kind of the larger landscape of all of the different types of eating disorders that we see today.
What have psychologists known up to this point about the physiological roots of eating disorders? Has there been a prevailing interpretation of why this happens?
Yeah, so as you mentioned in your intro, for a long time we've known that psychological and cultural factors contribute to the development of eating disorders, but probably starting about 20 years ago, there was an increasing recognition that biological and genetic factors likely contribute to these symptoms and disorders as well. So we've known for about 20 years now that the heritability of eating disorders and their symptoms, like binge eating, approximate the heritability that we see for other psychiatric disorders that we think have a pretty biological basis, like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, etc. So we know that the heritability is around 70% for these symptoms and disorders, and that was kind of the first clue to the field that maybe biological and genetic risk factors might be important, in addition to the psychological and cultural risk factors that we know are important.
And so what have we learned in the last couple of decades about these biological factors?
Well, we have learned, we've started to identify some genes that might increase risk for these symptoms. So you can kind of think about these genes as the background factor. So if you have a genetic risk for eating disorder, it means that you have several genes that increase the probability that you might develop an eating disorder or an eating disorder symptoms, but they don't de facto mean that you will develop it. It's this kind of background genetic risk that then interacts with environmental risk. What we're now realizing, so we know that there are some genes that are involved. What we're trying to do now is figure out what's the intermediary step between the genes and the disorder, and what are the biological processes that likely interact with the psychological and the cultural risk factors. And we're looking at lots of different biological systems. We're looking at things like serotonin functioning, which is known to be implicated in mood disorders. We're looking at reward processes within the brain, dopamine, kind of these neurotransmitters in the brain that increase the chances you're going to want to seek rewards like high-fat, high-sugar foods that we see during a binge, etc. So I would say the eating disorders field in general, we're still kind of catching up to other fields in terms of looking at these biological risk factors, but we're starting to find some systems that are likely involved.
What do your fellow researchers in the field have to say about this? What are your colleagues, what are they saying?
Well, what's interesting is that when I first entered the field about 20 years ago, people were really hesitant to think that genetic and biological risk factors might contribute to eating disorders, but I would say pretty much across the board now, the field of eating disorders, researchers, clinicians, medical doctors, all believe there is a significant genetic and biological risk to these disorders. Now is the key, the key piece for us now is trying to figure out what exactly are these biological factors that increase the risk.
It is pretty extraordinary that we're talking to you this morning because 39 minutes ago, NPR aired a story, and I'm going to forget the organization, so bear with me on this, but the gist of the story was there is some kind of scientific body that claimed that the handbook or the manual, I want to say it's for the American Psychological Association, does not include enough data related to genetics and neurological factors in their handbook. And you and I, 40 minutes later, are having this conversation, which is so closely hinged to genetic, the genetic and the neurological. Do you have any comment? It's taken 20 years for it to reach this point. Is that too slow in your view? Does this process need to be sped up?
You know, I think all of us would like science to move quicker. If we could get science to move quicker, that means we could figure out the causes and we could end up with more effective treatments quicker. I think the danger there is that we have lots of examples of individuals who rushed in their scientific findings and their scientific data to get findings out into the literature and to prematurely publish results that ended up being false. And the risk with doing that is that you then get treatments that not only get propagated as being perhaps effective for a disorder or a symptom, but and that actually aren't effective. You can also get treatments that are put into practice that are actually harmful. So I don't think you'd find any scientist that wouldn't say, yes, let's do this quicker, but I think there's also reason for us all to be careful, thorough, comprehensive in the sorts of research that we do to make sure that we don't disseminate findings and disseminate treatments before we know, A, they're effective, and B, most importantly, they aren't harmful.
What an interesting 21st century conundrum to have. And I suppose it all relates back to how quickly we're able to learn things in 2013. We learn something really important, and then we immediately want to learn what's next as quickly as possible, but the process can only be sped up so much. That's kind of the heart of the issue, correct?
Exactly, yes. Has
your work been peer-reviewed?
Yes.
Okay. And what could be, I'd like to go a little bit further into the genetic implications here. How might this factor into the nature versus nurture theory? What have we learned about, the human genome was such an explosion in terms of knowledge here in the past decade. How might that aid your research?
Well, I'm hoping it will aid my research quite a bit. You know, now from the human genome to where we are in terms of genetic technologies, when we want to look at the genes for a trait or disorder, it used to be 15 years ago, you would pick out 6 genes. And to some extent, you would almost pick them randomly. You would base them on theory, but we had no idea what these genes did. Now, in 2013, I'm currently actually running some samples in my lab looking at human DNA in individuals recruited here in Michigan, and we are looking at 200,000 variants of different genes across the genome. And as you can imagine, having that amount of information available to be able to look to see which of these variants seem to cluster together, which of these variants seem to together increase risk for a symptom or disorder, gives us much more power for understanding the genetic basis of these disorders. We no longer have to kind of guess ahead of time and say, we think it's this, 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 and this, and oh, God forbid, it wasn't those, and you've just spent a lot of money looking at those, and you don't get any bang for your buck. We can now look across all of the different variations of genes in the genome and look using much more powerful statistical approaches for clusters of genes, groups of genes that might be contributing to the trait or disorder. So it's a really exciting time, I would say, for biological and genetic research, and I think another advance over the past 20 years is we can now do this in both humans and animals. And, of course, you can do things with animals that you can't do with humans. And so combining the human and the animal approaches, I think it's going to be a really fruitful way to understand not only the genetic basis of these disorders, but then translating the genes that we identify into the biological processes that they code for is going to go a long way in understanding at least that biological genetic piece of the puzzle.
What's the future of the treatment itself, though? I mean, is it premature to leap ahead? I can't help but think forward 20 years or 10 years or whatever. How do you see this impacting treatment?
I do see it impacting treatment, and I see it impacting both pharmacological treatment, so drug treatments for the disorders, but also psychotherapy for the disorders. So, for example, in depression, they're doing really interesting studies where they're looking at individuals who don't respond to psychotherapy for depression, or they don't respond to pharmacological treatment for depression. And what they're doing is they're taking a look at those individuals, and they're looking at their genetic risk, and they're looking at their biology. And what they're finding is that response to different treatments varies depending upon your genetic background. And so where we could be in 10 to 20 years is that if you present to a clinic with a psychiatric disorder, they may run some biological tests, they might grab your DNA, and based on some biological biomarkers and some of the different combinations of genes, they may be able to tell you, given your biological background, this is the treatment that's going to be most effective for you. And so as you can imagine, that is going to decrease suffering, it's going to decrease the cost of mental health care. It could just have huge implications both for the suffering of individuals and also public health in terms of costs for treatment.
Dr. Kelly Klump is a Michigan State University psychologist who studies binge eating and its possibly biological roots. Dr. Klump, thanks very much.
Thank you.